Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv Khanna for immigration.com. It's a conference call we have every other Thursday. Today is May 21st, 2009. This call is being recorded, so anybody who does not wish to participate in this call, please hang up. Any answers I give are basically not an attorney-client relationship. They are just being given in the spirit of helping the community. And I do my best. I can always make mistakes. This is not the same thing as having a one-on-one consultation. I rely upon the information that I get from you. And, you know, that may not be sufficient, but we try our best. Keep this in mind, okay? Now, let me get to the questions that were posted on forums.immigration.com. The first question, H-1B, this is from Madhu 16. H-1B pending for around 11 months, but visa is valid till 2010. I have a valid H-1 visa. I-94 is till October 2010 with Company A. In June, I filed H-1B transfer for Company B, which is yet to be approved. Got an RFE, submitted the client letter and contract. Not sure whether Company A revoked my H-1B, and Company B is running my pay stubs. Since June 2008, which is around 11 months. Is it legal to work for Company B on receipt number for more than 180 days? In my opinion, yes. Yes. There are two provisions of law that kind of militate here. One is the AC-21 portability, which, to the best of my knowledge, gives you no limit on how long you can continue working once your case has been filed. And the other one is the law, it's a regulation that permits you to continue working for 240 days, approximately 8 months. Okay. If you have joined on AC-21 portability, which is what you seem to have done, basically you were in status and you joined, it appears to me that you can continue working. Okay. I don't think it should be a problem, even though it has gone past, 8 months or 240 days. It looks to me like you can continue working. I have never really studied this issue in detail, but off the top of my head, this is what I think the law should be. To avoid the consequences of H-1B rejection, I'm planning to change to F-1. Why do you want to change to F-1? That's not going to be any better. I think you should wait and see what happens with your H-1. Okay, and if possible, contact your local congressman's office and find out what's going on. Why is this case taking so long? Only thing I'm not sure about is maybe your employer is under investigation. That could cause some delays as well. So figure that out. But I don't think converting to F-1 is necessarily a good idea. Question number 3 from R. Sharmas. Came to this country in December 2007 on H-4. Applied for H-1, got H-1 in October 2008, but could not find job. March 2009, went to India and returned on my H-4 visa. My husband's I-140 is approved, but 485 is still pending. He had applied concurrently. I have not yet been added to his 485 application. Question number 1, can I continue looking out for a job? Yes, yes, and you can transfer your H-1 because you were out of status. However, you went out and you came back on H-4 status. The fact that you have an H-1 approval allows you to transfer that H-1 even if you never worked for that company. So you're not subject to the quota. Question number 2, my husband's company is going under. Can he change jobs and start working on his EAD? What are my options to avoid going out of status? If he does not have an H-4, then you don't have, he does not have an H-1, you don't have an H-4. So you can't be on H-4. Your only option then is to convert to an H-1. You can certainly try moving to a student visa. Okay? That, you know, is a discussion of INS. But H-1 is the way to go. If you can get on to H-1, get a job, that is the best thing for you. Question number 4 is from M-A-I-L-D-I-V-S, Male Divs. Entered USA on H-4 visa a couple of years back, got an H-1B in October 2008. I don't have a job. Is there a way I can go back to H4 without having to travel to India? Very difficult, because you've been out of status for a long time. Assuming that when you got the H1B, you also got an I-94, which means you basically got a change of status, what that would do is in 2008, October, you stopped being on H4 status, you went on to H1 status. And since you didn't join the company, you lost status. Now, if you did not receive a change of status from H4 to H1, then you're fine. Okay, but within USA, it will be very difficult for you to convert back to H4. I'm a musician, and the performing organization is willing to file a P3. Do I need to go back to India, get stamping done? That's probably what will happen. Okay, because if you disclose to INS that you are out of status, which you must disclose, then they'll probably ask you to go back to India to get your visa stamping. Okay, that's what I would recommend. So, even if you file the I-129, whatever you do for the P visa or H visa, ultimately, I think it will involve a trip to India. And I'm not that concerned. I mean, this is especially for H-4 visa. I mean, H-4 visa is a very solid visa. You should be able to come back. When you go to the consulate, make sure you don't lie about anything. Whatever they ask you, tell them truthfully. But there is also no requirement that you volunteer information about yourself. The DS-156, the form that you file for the visa stamping, does ask you, have you been in USA without status, etc., and you must answer the question truthfully. Jack wants to know, this is question number 5, H1 and H4. It says, I-94 and petition are expiring on 2nd June. Labor and I-140 is approved, but I'm out of project. I don't have a client letter or work order. I read in your blog, H1 laid out scenario, I can legally stay in USA by filing change of status to B2. The problem is, sir, if you're already out of status, then filing for a change of status doesn't work. Okay, it doesn't work. But the problem is you're confusing expiration of I-94 with status expiration. You see, when you stop working and you're not getting paid your full salary, you're already out of status. Okay, so filing for a B visa in that circumstance is not going to work. So there is no good answer for you other than to leave USA. Of course, if you get another job, that would work great. But a B2 is unlikely to work in your case. Next question is FDTK 2003. Father came to USA on visitor visa, which is valid for 10 years. He overstayed by three days because he was sick. Should my father go to U.S. Embassy in New Delhi? Look, I don't think he needs to, Ahmed, but, since he's going to travel from so far, I don't want anybody at the airport to tell him, oh, you have to return back. Okay, so I think if it were my father, I would probably have him go and apply for the tourist visa again. Chances are the consulate will tell him you don't need to apply for a new visa. If they tell him not to apply for a new visa and the old visa is still good, you're all set. Let him travel. Okay? That's the way I would look at it. Next question is IRABA 96. EB2 priority date is June 2006. I'm on EAD. Third one, searching for jobs. Would it be prudent to apply for unemployment while being on EAD? That's a question that's very difficult for me to answer. People do say that USCIS looks out for these claims and they might come after you. I don't know if there is a good answer to this question. I don't know anybody who was actually sought out by USCIS just because they had applied for unemployment insurance. And as far as I know, unemployment insurance is not the same thing as being what you said as the ward of the state. Basically, unemployment insurance is a private insurance. The employer pays for it, and the money comes to you. You are not relying upon government funding as far as I understand. So in my view, filing for unemployment claim by itself is not a ground for denial of the green card, as far as I know. Okay. Add to it the AC-21. You know, if your I-140 is already approved, you are allowed to take advantage of AC-21. So in between, if you have taken unemployment compensation, I don't think that should be that big an issue, as long as you can provide a letter from a current or a prospective employer who offers you a similar job as described in your labor certification, if INS asks for an employment letter. So in my view, it should not be a problem. But I cannot tell you that this is the most definitive answer for the simple reason I don't know of any case in which INS has come after somebody. Can they potentially? Well, yeah, but is it terminal for your green card because you are not working? I'm pretty sure it is not. Okay, so therefore, combining all the things that I know, and without there being a concrete case in hand, I would say it's fairly safe to apply for unemployment insurance when you are in EAD 485 status. It may not be the same thing when you're in H1 because you're out of status right away, or L1, you're out of status right away. Okay. Next question, Harry 536. Implications of forced shutdown on H1B status. Currently, I'm working on H1B. My company has decided to have a forced shutdown 1 day per week, so all employees will be working only 32 hours. We cannot use the paid leave also. In my LCA, the prevailing wage 52K and my salary is on I-129 64.5K. Your questions are, is working 32 hours considered to be full-time? No, no. Full-time is 35 hours, 35 hours, okay? My effective annual salary will be less than 64K. Will I be out of status? You know, I think your company should go ahead and file an H1 amendment. And they can do an amendment for 30 to 40 hours or 30 to 35 hours. That way they're obligated to pay you for only 30 hours, but they can pay you up to 40. Okay? So it's really not that big a deal. They can file an amendment. And if they do an amendment without an extension, it usually just is $300-$400 to do it. That's all the filing fees. If I try for H-1B transfer after a few months, can that be denied? Yes, it can be denied because you're making less than what you're supposed to be making. Actually, it is the company that's on the line. If they don't amend the petition and they start paying you less than they're supposed to, you can always claim from them the money that's owed. They're not allowed to do that. It's illegal for them to do that. If a company files LCA H-1B amendment, do they have to use the wage survey for 2009? They have to use the wage survey that is the most recent one. Okay. Do they evaluate the entire H-1B application again? Yes, they do. Can the H-1B amendment be denied? Yes. A denial, an extension, or a transfer are all just treated just like a new application. INS can reopen everything. Next question is from Rajdeep Singhan. He is getting a salary hike on H-1B. 485 is pending since July 2007. I-140 was approved in Feb 2009. I used a pre-approved labor cert. Currently, I'm an H-1B with the same employer, almost 2 years now. My question is it okay to take a pay hike with my current employer around $10,000 in my situation? Is there any long-term impact? Well, sir, it depends. Somebody has to look at your labor certification, see what the salary mentioned there was. Oh, you have given that figure. The pre-approved labor used 65K. Currently, what are you making? H-1B is between 65 and 90. The company's formal offer letter that was given to me at the time of joining was 80 plus bonus. See, it's difficult for me to answer this question, Raj, whether it's okay or not. Talk to your green card lawyers. The standards that I use are these. Look, I think in the IT industry, 8 to 10% raise per year is not really abnormal. So if the labor cert was filed in the year 2002, and you start calculating 8 to 10% raise per year, that should be okay. If the company can prove that, and these are all things that are not written down. These are just things from common sense. Or if the company can prove that the raises that they gave you are normal raises for their company, you know, 12% or 13% or whatever. I think you should be okay. But it's a difficult question to answer in the abstract. So first thing I look for, what is normal? Second thing I look for is, has the job description changed? That, of course, is the most important thing. These are some items I look at. And remember, you always have the option of, once your I-140 is approved, file a second green card. And then take the priority date of the old case and transfer it to the new one. Okay, that is always an option. Rather than, you know, trying to play all these interesting games, mind games with INS, we can just go ahead and file a new green card for you and still get the priority date of the old case over, okay? Shaila Z wants to know, entered USA on H-4, October 2007, got H-1. Recently, resigned from job April 15th, 2009. Before I could apply for H-4, husband lost job on April 20th. His new employer took some time to apply for his H-1 and my H-4. What happens if my employer revokes my H-1? Well, you are out of status. Okay. But the good news is, it is for such a short duration. If you leave to go to India in the next few weeks, you should be okay. Taking the worst case scenario, start counting yourself as being unlawfully present from April 15th, although you're not. But let's say you are. If you leave within 180 days, you incur no permanent damage. Okay, remember, people who are out of status can be deported if they are found out, but chances of that happening are small. And usually USCIS is not that heartless. Of course, you know, who knows what they do. But generally speaking, you should be safe if you leave within 180 days of that, of April 15th. 1389, laid off, AOS pending, can I travel and when? Well, first of all, in your case, your lawyer's paralegal is advising you. Well, that is a very dangerous thing to do. The paralegal has no right to advise anybody, and that's very strict instructions in my office. You know, no paralegal is allowed to advise about law, and obviously what they're advising to you is wrong, in my opinion. Please talk to your lawyer, not to your lawyer's paralegal. Let's look at your question. Been in H-1B status valid till 2010. EB-3 AOS pending since August 2007. Both are with the same employer. They decided to lay me off. They put me on a leave of absence till June 30th. First of all, leave of absence means nothing. Leave of absence in almost all cases like yours amounts to nothing. You are still out of status as far as H-1 is concerned. But because your AOS is pending, you are in authorized period of stay. I would like to travel to my home country for a few weeks. The lawyers, paralegal said I can do that while on this leave of absence, but not later. This is very bad advice. What you need to do is, first of all, if you start, try to enter using the same H-1 visa when you don't have a job, INS can treat that as fraud. If you come back on AP and the officer at the port of entry asks you where you're working, you have to tell them the truth. You have to tell them that you're not working anywhere. And that can itself be a ground for refusing you entry. So that's why it's very dangerous for you to rely upon the advice of your paralegal. Please talk to the lawyer. There's a reason he has a license to practice and she or he, the paralegal, does not. Okay. Should I try to get a new H-1 stamp? Oh, no. If the job is ending, absolutely not. The paralegal also told me not to apply for unemployment benefits. You are, if you're on EAD, I've just discussed this topic. I think it's okay to do so. But keep looking for a job. Okay. I've answered these questions for us about the unemployment insurance. So just listen to my answers from before. Question number 12 is Sanchalanam Sanchi. H-1B transfer, incorrect hiring date. I am on H-1 since 2003. I changed employer in May 2004 from A to B. Last date with A is May 21st. Joined company B on May 24th. Company B actually filed for transfer in June instead of May. The interesting thing is, Sanchi, that according to Vermont Service Center, as long as you got your... Well, in your case, you did not get your H-1 filed. until June. Well, even though it may be considered to be illegal, if your employer, old employer, withdrew your H-1 before June 1st, okay, June 1st is when the transfer was filed. If the old employer withdrew your H-1 before June 1st, you might have a bit of an illegal problem. But if they did not withdraw your case until after June 1st, then even receiving that payment on AC-21 portability appears to be okay under the law. That's the recent opinion of Vermont Service Center. A couple of months ago, they had mentioned that in one of our conferences. Okay. What is my correct start date? You should always put down the start date as the true date. Not, you know, if you started work on May 21st, put down that date. Okay, can I show paychecks to prove that I was employed by company B? Lastly, I'm wondering whose mistake is this? Innocent employee who believed HR or the employer? Well, obviously it is the employer's mistake. But I don't believe it should come back and haunt you. Okay? As long as no misrepresentations have been made in the H-1 filing, and of course you don't have any control over that. I feel that you should be okay, but my very strong advice to you, Sanchi, is this. Make sure that your H-1 is filed premium processing. If it was not filed premium processing, get it premium now. I think it would be important for you. Okay? Because we want to know very quickly what INS is going to think about it. You have a second question. I don't answer subsequent questions. I try to keep it to, you know, one set of questions. So I'm going to have to go on to next question. Umesha, number 14. Came to USA with a visa waiver. Husband filed for I-130, which is still pending. Husband doesn't work, but is supported by mother. Do we have a chance to get approved? Yes. If mom has enough money to support both of you, it can happen, especially if she signs, co-sponsoring affidavit. But if he can't prove that he can support you, then of course there is no chance. And as far as I remember, the fact that you came on a visa waiver, you can still apply for adjustment of status if you get married to a U.S. citizen. You can have it confirmed, but this is what I remember off the top of my head. So, for visa waiver people, this is the only exception, getting married to a U.S. citizen, and they can still have adjustment of status. Next question is from Zero Stomach. Pretty impressive. He has 186 posts. Well, that's good to know, sir. You've been very active. Let's see. You've been on the forums for a good 2 years. Excellent. Dear sir, I'm going to file I-485 in family-based preference immigration. Couple of questions. Father doesn't have a source of income, never filed taxes. Well, of course, if he never has income, he's not required to. So the fact that he's never filed taxes should not be a complication. Okay, so don't worry about that part. I think you should be fine. Next question is from R. Haran, priority date and AC-21. I answered his question earlier. He had talked to me before the conference started. And the issue in his case was that when his I-140 was approved, the priority date was put down wrongly as the date his labor cert was approved, instead of the date the labor cert was filed. So I told him to go back and get that corrected, because the priority date is not the date labor cert is approved. It is the date the labor cert is officially received and filed by the Department of Labor. Okay. Next question is Drudge. Petitioner sponsor needs to be in USA when beneficiary enters? No. The petitioner or the sponsor has to be domiciled in USA. They have to be, you know, actually living in USA, but they don't have to be physically present when the beneficiary enters, as far as I know. You can double-check this with the CBP. I don't know of any law that says they've got to. If you're just going temporarily for a month or so, I think that should be fine. But by the way, CBP, Customs and Border Protection, are pretty helpful. They do have the answers for you. So if you go to cbp.gov and call their helpline, they can answer this question for you. Many times when I am in doubt about something which regulations are not clear about and, you know, there is no clear precedent, I have had our office call CBP as well. And we were very, very happy to see that most of the CBP officers that we have spoken with have been well informed, and they were able to give us good information. Okay, most of us. I have had one or two times when I got really, really bad information. And of course, that's where the knowledge of law comes in. What they told me was so illegal that it didn't make any sense. Of course, we didn't follow their advice. But, you know, in your case, I think you should be fine. Indian Deep, Indian Deep, L2 EAD to H1 transfer. I'm currently working with company A on L2 EAD. I have an approved H1 petition from B. I never joined them, so no pay stubs. Can I transfer my H1 to company A? Well, first of all, a very important question would be this. When you got your H1 approval from company B, did you or did you not get a change of status? Because if you got a change of status, then you are out of status. Okay? And you've been working illegally. So what you need to do is go outside USA to your home country, get an L2 visa stamp, come back in, and then if you want to change from L2 to H1, there should be no problem. You do not need pay stubs necessarily to transfer an H1, not in your circumstances. I hope I made myself clear. Next question is, Jory, clarification on H1B and L1 Visa Reform Act. I have said this before, I do not usually study pending bills. The simple reason is, bills come and bills go. I am not a college professor, I'm a practicing lawyer. I only deal with a situation when it becomes imminent. This bill, God knows what's going to happen with it, whether it's going to be around tomorrow or day after tomorrow. So I'm not really going to worry about it until it becomes imminent that it's going to become a law. Okay? I have, like everybody else in the bar, I've looked at the bill briefly, but I haven't spent a lot of time researching or understanding what they are saying. So please, I will not be able to answer your question about the Visa Reform Act of 2009. Once it becomes closer to, you know, something that can possibly happen, I will, of course, post my commentary and be happy to answer your questions at that time. Okay, next question is, ZMB. Several years ago, I became a U.S. citizen. This is the question number 20. I will open the call after answering this question to see if you folks have any follow-ups on the questions I've answered so far, okay? Said MB says, several years ago I became a U.S. citizen. Then I sponsored my unmarried son. Okay, while the petition was pending, the son got married. What they do is they will convert his category to the married son, okay? I don't think they'll penalize you, but you need to let the consulate know about this marriage. So they will then put him in a different category. And if you go to the visa bulletin, it tells you what category he would be under now. They won't take away his green card rights altogether, but they will put him in a different category if he gets married. Okay? I'm pretty sure that's what they do. So just contact the consulate and inform them that a marriage has occurred. All right? Folks, I am going to open the conference now for questions, but I want you to remember, I first want to hear only from people who have posted their questions so far, from 1 to 20. The remaining 7-8 questions I'll answer in a minute, but anybody who has follow-up questions or who posted questions on from 1 to 20, go ahead and give me one second. If you press *6 on your phone, you can talk with me. *6.
Rajiv, this is Sanchi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Rajiv, the question that I requested actually, I'm already on H1. My new company filed for H1 in 2005 itself.
Okay.
And I have this H1 valid till 2011.
Okay.
But now I'm going for H1 stamping to India.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering how this... these dates will affect for visa extension.
Sati, what number are you?
I think it's 11.
I can find you, don't worry.
It's 11.
I see you. Thank you. 13. Oh, you have two, actually.
The one before. The first one.
Didn't notice, otherwise I wouldn't have answered the second question, but that's okay. H-1B transfer, incorrect hiring date. Oh, how will that affect the visa stamping? No problem.
Yeah.
I'm not...
Yeah, because I spoke with my attorney who filed for this H-1. I asked him in I-797, the receipt date shows June 2nd, actually...
This is a very minor matter.
But which date I should tell to an NFC?
The true date. May 21st.
Okay.
The true date.
My attorney is not suggesting that. I think he is suggesting me to use the date which is in I-797 because
that attorney is dangerous because he's advising you to lie. Okay. Now this is something I'm finding very objectionable, and I don't mind telling other colleagues at the bar, guys, don't do this. All these forms have consequences. Please don't misadvise your clients. This is such a bad idea. I would rather that you tell the truth and get into trouble. We can bail you out. But if you tell a lie and get into trouble, we can't bail you out. Do you realize that if somebody were to claim that you tried to obtain an immigration benefit through fraud or misrepresentation, you will be barred from entering USA permanently? It's a permanent bar. Okay? And I see absolutely no problem in this situation. Why do you want to create a problem? Do not listen to your lawyer. They are wrong.
Okay. I was actually concerned about only one thing because there are 2 weeks of gap between.
That is not a problem. You tell the truth.
Okay.
Do not hide anything. There is nothing in law that's going to hurt you. Even if it were, I would have told you, Sanchi, you have no choice but to tell the truth. Okay. In this case, there is nothing that's going to hurt you. So, why tell a lie? Tell the truth.
Okay, all right. One more question that he was talking, I'm just want to find the truth. The one more thing he was talking about is, The even though the receipt date is shown June 2nd, it's not actually the date that we got.
I believe that. I'll tell you why. Typically what happens is, let's say I file the papers today.
Okay.
They get to INS tomorrow. Okay. It takes them anywhere from 4 to 10 days just to enter the case in their system.
Okay.
Okay. So really, the receipt date that they give you is misleading because it's actually late by 4 to 10 days. So really, if you ask me what your filing date is, that is the date of the delivery of the case.
Okay. But is it true that since I'm work for more than a week, then the date that is showing on the I-797, doesn't it show that I have been working with this company illegally for 1 week or something like that?
No, because you're allowed to work under AC-21 portability.
Okay, I don't know what is that one.
Okay. Don't worry about it. Well, okay. Just take my word for it. You'll be fine.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Anytime. Good luck.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Rajiv. It's regarding the question number one.
You mean two. One is Monica.
Number two.
Okay. Madhu 16. Yeah.
Yeah. You said something about the AC-21 portability. I think it's related to the green card process.
No, AC-21 is in both things. There is an AC-21 for 485 portability, and there is an AC-21 for H-1 portability. See, AC-21 is merely a law.
Okay.
American Competitiveness in the 21st Century Act. That law changed two major provisions. One, it allowed you to change jobs when your green card was pending, and second, it allowed you to change jobs even before your H-1 gets approved. So it has both provisions.
Okay, so if it is AC-21 portability applied, then we can stay more than 240 days, right?
I never really thought about this because I don't recall ever thinking along those lines. You know, every day in law I learn something new too, and I learn from you guys. Just because I started thinking, I said, you know what, wait a minute. Yes, that regulation allows me to continue working 240 days. But AC-21 doesn't say how long I can work. AC-21 says you can continue working as long as the case is pending.
Okay.
Okay. I don't think there's a limit on it. But again, you know, I would have to really sit down and study the law in detail. Let your lawyers do that. They get paid to do it. You know, let them do it. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I think that should be true.
Okay. And, yes, sir. Thank you. I have one more question.
Sure.
It's in the forum. I'll take a question regarding the change of status to F1. You are saying that it's not necessary, but what my concern is, in case if my H1B got rejected, then can I again put the petition for the H1? So the Egyptians...
Let me make one thing clear to you.
Yeah.
Filing an F1 does not necessarily remove the necessity for you to travel outside the USA. Okay? Because remember, you are not in status. You are in authorized period of stay. And read my blog on this. These are two different things. INS normally does not give you status from being in authorized period of stay. So if you apply for an F1 now, they'll say, prove that you have status. And you'll say, well, I don't have status, but I have a case pending. Well, fine. When the case gets approved, file the F1. Then we'll do a change of status. So it does not really give you any benefit to apply for the F1. But please have your lawyers look into this specifically, whether I'm right or wrong. And if you figure out that I'm wrong, send me an email. I would like to know about it.
Okay, sure.
And you can send us an email from contact us form on the website.
Yeah.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anybody else, folks?
Hello, sir. This is Arhan.
What question number are you, sir?
This is number 16.
16?
Yes, sir.
16, of course, there's no 60, so it's got to be 16. Dumb. Okay. I see you, Mr. Harun.
Yes, sir. Sir, my employer is keep on telling that they change date and it's only after the approval date on the priority date.
You can have your lawyers verify that, or you can have your employer and yourself be on the phone at the same time when you call INS.
Okay.
And you might even be able to take an InfoPass appointment and go.
Okay, that's the one. And one more thing, for the AB-21, they are not
giving
me the approved labor.
See, this is a problem. I'm sorry, I forgot to address this issue. What I have told people is to file a Privacy Act request. There are two ways, easy ways to get a copy of your labor cert, or at least the job description. One is to just ask the lawyer. In many states, lawyers are required to treat both the employer and the employee on the equal footing. Because we've represented both sides in Virginia, I have to give you a copy of the labor cert if you ask for it.
Okay,
even if the employer says, no, you can't, I have to.
Okay.
Because I represent both sides. So asking the lawyers is one way to go. And the second is filing for something called a Privacy Act request. If you go to the INS website and just look for the form for FOIA, F-O-I-A, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA and Privacy Act form are the same form. A Privacy Act request basically just requests INS to give you a copy of all the documents they have on you. Often, when they give you a copy of all your documents, they give you a copy of the labor cert also.
Okay, they will give you the complete labor cert?
They might. It's worth trying.
Because in this case, I need to fix the date, right? My priority date. So they might be asking my labor cert, what is the labor
cert? I'm not sure what you're saying, Mr. Hearn, but I think... As far as getting a job description is concerned, that could be possible through these two methods.
Okay. No, my first question is that my priority date is wrong.
Right.
So in order to go and show to the INS the proof that I filed so-and-so date on my labor, mm-hmm. this should be my actual priority date.
Mm-hmm.
But for that, I need a copy of my labor, right?
First of all, you're right that you need to show them what date the labor cert was filed.
Yes.
But I'm confused about what you're asking me.
No,
if you want to know your job description and even a copy of your labor cert, there are only two sources. Ask your lawyer or ask the INS through a Privacy Act request. Those are the only two options. No matter what you want to do, those two options you have to exercise if you want a copy of your labor cert.
Okay. But there is no time limit to file the AC-21, right?
There is no time limit.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Is he?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. One, I believe my question was number 11. 1389. Is my name?
You don't have to give your name. You're on an open call here. You can just make up.
I mean, the signature was 1389.
Oh, okay.
And,
I see you.
And, I would like to double check. If I were to find a new job that's same or similar, can
Very
I then...
Good. Then there is no problem. What I would want you to do... And how do you pronounce your name? Uza?
Uza.
Uza. Okay. If you get a same or similar job, file your AC-21 and then travel. There is no problem.
Okay. Okay. So it is necessary to first file the AC-21 letter and then only travel.
I will be a lot more comfortable if you did that.
Okay.
Okay. Otherwise, I would always worry that CBP can turn me back.
And aside from that, is it necessary for me or is it beneficial to, once I find the same or similar job, also file an H-1?
I normally do that. And there is a reason for it, and I have it on my blog. If you go look at my blog, I have pointed out why I like people to have an H-1 going, even when they have an AC-21 or a 40-minute or a 45 going.
Okay. Well, if there's a several months between now and I find a new job,
you can always get H-1 approval and get a visa stamp later.
Okay.
You won't get H-1 within USA, but they'll approve the H-1, then you can go activate it whenever you feel like going and getting a visa stamp.
Will I be subject to the quota in this application for the new H-1?
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No problem at all.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Folks, anybody else?
Hi, Rajesh.
Yes,
this is question number 20.
Hello, sir.
Yeah,
hello?
Let me get 20 first, sir. Just one second. 20, oh, yes, from Pakistan. Assalamu alaikum.
You're welcome, Islam. Sir, the situation basically, wanted to clarify.
I thought
Do you mean that just on a plain piece of paper we informed the embassy over there that he has gotten married now?
I have not been in touch with, is this Lahore? Where is it pending?
Islamabad.
I really have not been in touch with Pakistan consulates for a while. We did some E2 visas, but they were all done through regular mails. But if I remember correctly, they used to be good about responding even to emails. So if you
right.
give your case number and send them an email, they should be able to fix it for you.
Okay. And then that means that we have to give them the information about the spouse and the kids so they can enter it. Do we have to do any dealings with the USCIS in the U.S. to amend the...
You should not have to do anything with the USCIS.
Or NVC.
Or with NVC either.
Okay, so the embassy alone should be able to take care of it.
As far as I know. And, again, these procedures are not written down anywhere. These are all local procedures. A lot of what consulates do is locally developed. I am talking from my experience dealing with several different consulates. So they should be able to follow this locally.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else?
Yes, sir. Hello?
Yes, sir.
Question number is 9.
Rajdeep, go ahead, Raj.
Yes, sir. What happens is I'm in the IT consulting field, so a lot of times we want to work on contracts and our pays are actually, verbally agreed.
Okay.
We get a percentage of our billing rate, which is definitely much higher than the one that is written in labor cert.
I have always felt that that's probably illegal. I've always felt that. Okay.
So how do I actually go, a lot of times the employer, just verbally agrees that, yes, okay, you'll get the 80% or 90% of your billing rate, which definitely amounts to, almost, if not double, then 1.5 times of what is there in H-1B or...
I think there is a problem with this from both a green card perspective and H-1 perspective. I'll get into that debate one time. I'll explain why I think these percentage rates are illegal and why employers should not do them.
Right.
But for now, my suggestion to you, sir, is to, get together with your lawyer, go over the case in detail, compare it with your labor cert substitution case that you have done. Figure out whether the salary is appropriate for that, considering how much you were paid and how much you're being paid. But at the same time, do keep in mind the option of filing a second green card. I think that's a good option for you. Did your I-140 got... You see, your I-140 is approved.
Yes, sir, yeah.
Once your I-140 is approved, the priority date becomes your property.
Absolutely, correct.
Okay, so why not file...
You're saying second green card with the same employer or a new employer, sir?
You can file it with the same employer. How big is the company? How many employees do they have?
Around 500.
So it's easy because if they give you the next promotion job, the next hired job... you can get more salary, and you might even, is this EB3 the old case? Yeah, EB3.
Right.
What are your qualifications? What degree do you have?
I'm actually eligible for EB2. I'm tech.
Then second case, you should file EB2 for the next higher job, and
right.
You should transfer the priority date. Very easy.
But that itself is, I spoke about it to my lawyer, and she's saying that the labor clearance itself is taking 1 year, almost eight months to 1 year, and then
sure.
We have to wait for EB2 140 also, which is another year.
But my concern is, why should you hold your career progression?
Okay.
This is so silly. I mean, in my mind, there is no doubt that if I were in your situation, or if I had a family member in your situation, I would have them file a second green card.
In EB2 category, and then
absolutely.
You know, whichever comes earlier. So EB3 suppose EB3 comes first for some reason, you know,
you
EB3.
You can take that. Now, INS could always question. So far, they've never done so, but they could question, why is this guy taking a lower job and he can also take a higher job? And the answer is, because I'm getting my green card.
So they
they could ask that, but you know, again, I don't think this would survive in court. If we took them to court over it, I would like to see them explain to a judge how I don't have the freedom to take a lower job if I want to.
Okay, because I have spoken to my employer, and he's ready to go for an EB2 category labor cert, and also my, you know, I've spoken to the lawyer also, they are ready to do that. It's just that I have to bear all the expenses, which is like $8,000 to $10,000, which I'm ready to do that.
Well, actually, you can't, because under the new law, the employer has to pay for the labor cert and all its expenses. That's the law. And
so,
if they try to circumvent that, that's a violation of the law, and they can be in big trouble.
Oh, really? I mean, if the check go from my side, is that what you're saying, sir?
No. Under the new regulations,
right.
The employer has to pay. If they want to hire a lawyer, or even if you hire a lawyer, they have to pay for the lawyer's fee as well as all the advertising expenses. You can pay I-140 onwards, you can pay. But 9089 and before, they have to pay for everything.
Okay. And by paying, you mean that the check actually has to go from the company and not a personal check from me, right?
Well, wait. Let's get one thing clear. It is not a question of check. It is the question of actual payment. If the employer tries to recover that money from you directly
yes.
or indirectly, they are in violation of law.
Oh, even then they are? Okay.
They have to pay for it from their own pocket.
Okay, because you said, you know, Raj, you can go ahead and file it. Only thing is you have to bear the lawyer expenses and the fee. So I said, okay, I can do that.
That is illegal. The company has to do it.
Oh, thank you for letting me know this, sir.
Your lawyer should know that.
Okay, no, I didn't know that at all. Okay.
Yeah.
I was ready to go ahead and file it at EB2 so that, you know, even if I can port my priority date, 2003 priority date.
Yeah, to EB2. That's the right.
Right. Okay, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Folks, anybody else? Okay. I'm going to go on with the other questions. Give me a second. Let me put the conference call back. Okay, so where are we? We did 20. Now we are on 21. CC ready. Quick summary of my case. Graduated in December 2007. Applied for H-1 in 2008. Got it approved. After which I came to India for vacation. Went to Chennai Consulate for change of status from F-1 to H-1B. They issued me 221G. And I've been waiting to hear from them. If I go for F-1 stamping, can I apply for F-1 visa while my H-1 is pending? Yes, you can. Will they decline my H-1 before I get my F-1? Not necessarily. What are the chances of getting F-1 while H-1 is pending? Very difficult to say. Very, 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 very difficult to say. Okay? That's not something I can predict. Can you do it? Yes. Will you get it? I don't know. What would I do if I were you? I would try for the F-1. At the most, they can only say no. As long as I don't lie to them, there is no problem. Next question, number 22, Mir_0907. I'm planning to apply for extension of stay for my visiting parents. They are on B2. What are the additional documents that might be useful other than the I-539? I think there was a list of things they might be posted on the INS website. Typically, they like to see evidence of ties with your home country. It's not required, but it'll help. They want to see a return ticket. I think that is required. So ties with the home country, how they are going to support themselves, things like that might help. Is there any deadline for applying for extension? I haven't looked into this law for a while, but when I looked into it 3-4 years ago, the law used to say, and of course they never followed that, but the law used to say, you must file for a B2 extension no earlier than 60 days before the I-94 expires, and no later than 30 days before it expires. So between 30 and 60 days before the I-94 expires used to be the law. Is it still the law? I do not know. You can check the regulations on our website. If they are not there, send me an email. I'll have them posted. Everybody should know what the regulations kind of say. Ramesh Gattu is 23. I got I-140 EB3 approval from Company A with 2002 priority date. I-140 EB2 approval from Company B. We requested to retain old priority date. Didn't I just deal with this issue? I'm confused. Okay. I thought I just talked about this issue. So, this is a different one. Okay. So they tried to transfer the priority date, but the I-140 did not reflect the priority date. Applied I-35 from Company B, but he's being told that the company withdrew the case. Look, even if the company withdraws the case, the I-140, you should be able to take your priority date, unless the only time I know when INS starts creating problems is if they withdrew the I-140 and use the labor cert for somebody else. Okay, then they might say that you can't use the priority date. Frankly, I think you're still entitled to it. At least you can try. You should fight with INS and you should try to get it back. Okay, so I certainly feel that you should fight with the INS for it. Question number, can your office deal with this case? Yes, of course, we will try. I will not guarantee you any results, but I will certainly guarantee you a good fight. Next question is sub_UFM. RFE subsequent to wife's adjustment of status interview, marriage certificate and income tax return. I am a U.S. citizen sponsoring my wife for green card. We went for an interview. They want to have a marriage certificate from the local registrar or a non-availability. You probably need to get what they ask you to get. By the way, the non-availability is merely a letter, and that can be obtained. People do it all the time. Just a letter on the registrar's letterhead saying that we don't have any availability of this certificate, that this marriage was never registered with us. Okay? You can, in addition to that, you must get that. In addition to that, you can get affidavits from people who attended the marriage, and you can show pictures of the wedding, wedding card, anything else that common sense says proves that the marriage occurred. Okay? Number two, we also need to submit 2008 income tax. Will this cause a problem because we filed, she was out of status? See, the out of status is not a problem for a spouse of a green, for a U.S. citizen. Okay, so definitely that should not be a problem. Don't worry about that part. Okay, good luck. 25 is Pank. I'm on H-1B. I-140 was filed, subsequently approved in EB3. When can I file 45? Well, you have to follow the visa bulletin. It's on our website. It's also on State Department's website. It's on immigration.com. You can look for visa bulletin. It's also on travel.state.gov. And I think we used to send visa bulletin by email also, as does State Department. And if you go to our website, there's a link where to subscribe, or you can go to travel.state.gov and you can subscribe. H1 being terminated, this is 26. Okay, we are doing very well today. Just a couple of questions left, and it's almost 3 o'clock. Artura, H1 being terminated, is it legal to stay while waiting for I-539 for F1 approval? And the answer is yes. If you apply for your I-539 before your H1 status goes away, that is, you stop working or you stop getting paid, if you get your 539 filed before that, you can continue to wait. Okay. But if you are even late by even one day, you cannot wait. You cannot stay in U.S. Well, at least I would not advise you to. So question number one, can I stay? The answer is yes. The university is willing to offer me assistantships. However, while the F1 is not reinstated, can I join my program officially? You can actually, if I remember correctly, you can actually, F1 is one of the few visas where you, the fact that you filed allows you to start taking classes. Okay. So you may not be able to take assistantships, but you can start taking classes. I think I've got everything, Ritesh. I'm not sure. If you are on the phone, you can ask me any follow-up questions. I think I've covered your issues. And the last question for the day is citizenship and marriage questions. Filed N-400 in September. Got married in December. Okay, that's fine. I filed N-400 as a single. Now I'm married. What to do now? What you can do is, the easiest thing to do is, take an info pass, go downtown, tell them that you are married, and they can amend the N-400. Although, if I remember correctly, when you go for oath, they will actually ask you if anything has changed, and you can make the changes then. Okay. But the easiest thing is just take an info pass and do it. Otherwise, go to your congressman's office and have them arrange for it to be changed. You do not have to get married again in the U.S. If the marriage was valid in the USA, in India, it is also valid in the USA. So if the marriage is valid in the USA, it is recognized in If the marriage is valid in India, it is also recognized in USA. No problem at all. Okay? What is the quickest way for her to get here? Well, you can look at, spouse visa, the K-3 option, and the I-130. I believe the times are maybe shorter for the K-3, but you can check around with people. Even send me an email. We can kind of give you an assessment. I don't remember off the top of my head what the time periods are. But K-3 and I-130 green card are the only two options that you've got. Okay? I think I've covered everybody's questions. Let me do the same thing again. See if anybody has any follow-ups. Star 6 to talk with me. Go ahead, please. Anybody has any follow-up questions? Yeah? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you all. Go ahead.
This is Raj, sir.
Yeah, Raj.
So what is the fee normally for EB3 to EB2 transfer or applying afresh for labor and all that?
Are you asking our fees, our green card?
Yes, for the lawyer fee.
It is on our website. I don't remember, sir. I am pretty sure it is in the neighborhood of $6,000, but I don't remember, all the way to the end of the green card. Our office does not charge for any fees for renewal of APs and EADs and all that.
You don't charge that?
No, we don't.
That's great.
Our fees is all standard. It includes everything all the way to the end, includes your family, includes everybody. But, the fees is on our website. Please don't ask me. We are one of the few law firms that gives you the entire fees on the website itself. Easy way to find out is if you go to our website, immigration.com, on the right-hand side, it says newtoimmigration.com, and under that, it says our fees. Click on that.
Okay, sir. Okay.
Okay.
And how easy is it is to, because my current case is with my current lawyer, so if I need immigration...
I don't think that should be a complication at all, Raj, your current lawyer seems to be competent. I mean, I don't know why you would want to change lawyers. I have no problem.
They are charging me for EAD also, for AP every time.
No, we don't do that. We don't charge. See, those are the hidden fees. We have no hidden fees. Everything is stated up front.
Right, it's like $250 for per application, so I end up paying almost $2,400 for my whole family every year.
We don't charge for any of that. That's all encouraged not to.
All right, sir. Can I talk to Matthew or Sumanji for this?
Yeah, of course.
All right.
You already know everybody in the office. Yeah, of course.
Sir, I've been fighting hard for it.
Yeah.
All right, sir.
No problem at all. And you can always send me an email too. If you just send an email through contact us, it goes to Sumanji and she forwards it to me or whoever else who needs to.
All right, sir. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Hi,
Mr. Raji, this is Lalita.
Yes, Lalita ji, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm calling about question number 24.
24. Lalita ji, you're going to have to speak up a little bit. Speak like Jhansi Kirani.
Huh?
24. Hang on 1 second. Don't speak like Abla Nari, speak like Jhansi Kirani.
Okay.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so this is regarding the adjustment of cases, and we attended the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a letter from the embassy stating that we were husband and wife.
See, that doesn't help. That doesn't help. That never helps. The non-availability certificate is not that difficult. It's just basically a letter. All that letter says is, we have no record of this marriage. That's all you need.
And, the registrar in Chennai, refusing to give such a certificate.
They do give letters. Of course they do. People get them all the time. But Mother India, you know how wonderful she is. You have to know people before they can get anything done. Even the smallest things, you have to have some sifarish or some approach.
So this non-availability has to be given, signed by the registrar, right?
It has to be signed by the proper office.
Okay, because in Chennai, they were told that there is no provision to give a non-availability.
Of course there is. Don't call it non-availability certificate. Just say, we want a letter that says there is no record of this marriage. That's all. See, if you say non-availability certificate, the government servant gets into a tizzy. My God, non-availability certificate. We have no certificate. That's all right. I just want a letter, sir. Yeah. Don't pass out. I don't want a certificate. I just want a letter that says there is no record of this marriage having been registered here. That's all.
Okay. And they should be able to do that.
Yeah, don't call it certificate of non-availability. They'll pass out. What? Certificate of non-availability? I don't know what that is. Don't worry about that. Just a letter, sir.
Okay, and do we have to substantiate with anything else?
I'm sorry, yeah, then you should get affidavits from people who attended the marriage.
Okay.
And I think we have an affidavit format. Just send us an email through contact us form and just say, Rajiv, I was in the conference, I need a sample affidavit for marriage. Those affidavits don't even have to be notarized. They are just plain paper affidavits.
Okay,
I'll send you a sample. You can send it to some people who attended the marriage. Attach with it photograph and attach with it your marriage card, invitation card.
Okay.
Okay.
And the other issue is that I was in an H-1 and...
Yeah, that's not a problem. Because even if you're out of status, that doesn't hurt you. Because getting married to a U.S. citizen... Getting married to a U.S. citizen is like taking a dip in the River Ganges. All your sins are washed away.
So I can
go
to the country even though my H-1 is not stamped.
It should be okay.
Yeah, because I have an advanced parole
now. No, don't travel. For that you need to consult a lawyer before you travel. Don't travel. But everything else is fine. Just go ahead and get this evidence. You should be all taken care of. It's not that difficult to get, trust me.
Okay.
All right. But just don't call it certificate of non-availability. Nobody knows what that means.
Okay.
That's what the U.S. government calls it. They don't call it that over there.
Yeah, because I know there is a non-availability for the birth certificate.
Even that is not really a certificate. They have come to realize that they've come to call it that, but it's not really a non-availability certificate. All it is a letter, basically. All right.
So in case I have to travel, then I have to consult a lawyer?
Oh, please talk to a lawyer before you travel. Do not travel just like that, because I don't know what the facts of your case are. Somebody needs to sit down and go over everything and make sure you're not subject to 310 bar. You know, you're not going to have any other problem. So we just want to make sure of all of that before you travel.
Okay.
What
do you do with the consulting for that?
Where are you located? Which city?
I'm in California.
You know, the reason, we have clients in all 50 states, in every major city in this country we have a client, okay? But for marriage-based cases, I often tell people, if you want more convenience, you may want to travel, talk with somebody local. The reason is, if tomorrow you want somebody to go to the interview with you, if there's another interview, a follow-up interview, and you don't feel comfortable having a lawyer in another city, you may want to talk to somebody local. But if you are comfortable with us being in Washington, D.C., no problem. I'll be happy to talk to you. I have no problem. I can certainly do it, but if you are more comfortable with a lawyer in a local location, get yourself a local lawyer. This is not rocket science. It's not a very complicated issue of law. It's just that somebody has to sit with you and go over your history.
Okay.
But yeah, of course, we'll be happy to do it for you.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Hey, Rajiv.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
This is question number 27.
27, okay. Let's see what 27 is. Citizenship and marriage. Enforced under single oath. Yep. I told you to just go ahead and let them know that you are married now.
Now, is it a good idea to wait until oath and then tell
no,
or
no,
just
no,
go
just,
and...
just take an info pass and go.
Now, is that for filing K3, what is the kind of a timeline? Is that the best option or...?
I think that is the best option, the fastest option, but I'll have to check with somebody in the firm. People who do those cases day in, day out. I don't remember all the details, but if I remember correctly, that is the fastest option. And there is a way to do it through India also. There is a INS office in New Delhi.
Uh-huh.
And if you file through that, everything gets done a lot quicker. But I think they used to have a requirement that you must have lived in India for 60 days before they would accept the application. I don't know if they still have the same rule.
But the girl is in India, though. So do I have
you are the petitioner. You are the petitioner, not she.
Oh, I see. Okay. So do I have to be... So is it in favor or a better advantage if I go there and then...
Yeah, look, I'm talking from my past experience. There are so many different kind of cases we do. I don't remember exactly what the, we were doing a count on how many cases I have done. And even very, very conservatively, the number was 50,000. I think the number is closer to 100,000. But, we did a very conservative count because we had to submit an affidavit in court about my expertise. So it was 50,000 cases that I have done. So you can imagine how am I going to remember all these details? All I remember is, and there are people in the firm who specialize in family-based cases. They'll be able to give us advice. If we ask them, if they know the numbers off the top of their head, they will. Otherwise, we'll let you contact the INS office in New Delhi to find out from them what they want you to do. My understanding is it's a lot quicker to do it here.
I see. Okay. I don't mind going there if that expedites in some way. And that only gives, what is the next steps after K3?
Basically what happens is when she comes on K3, she lands here and you apply for her adjustment of status.
I see.
It's as
in the meantime, once the status is applied, she is free to work.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think on K3 itself, she's allowed to work.
I see. So is there any duration for the visa they gave for K3 or it's kind of unbounded or...
I think they gave K3 for 6 months. The approval is for 6 months. I had a case recently from California. The guy got the K3 approval, but they gave them so many hassles that the approval expired. So he called us, and he was a good friend of my sister, so I had somebody from my firm call, and we figured out that the consulate can actually give an extension even if it expires. So even though INS gives the approval of the K3 for 6 months, a counselor can extend it further if they want to. So,
I see.
So basically all you need is enough time for her to enter USA and do a 485. That's easy enough.
Now, on the other hand, I went on March 13th for the interview. And I that was successful. And the only thing is, they wanted some more information about, they asked in the application, do you have any record or whatever. So I was open enough. I had a minor accident.
Right.
For some reason, they thought it's an error. I have never been arrested in life. And I submitted, but I have not received the oath yet. It seemed like it's taking longer.
I'm not that concerned about that. But look, if you're concerned about the time, you should contact your congressman's office. Let them figure out. And usually congressmen are too happy to help people in your situation because you're also their vote. Okay, so contact your congressman's office. They can figure out what the delay is.
I see. Now, is it a good idea to contact now or just wait till because it is...
I see no harm in contacting now.
What is the process? Is there any protocol to follow?
It should be on our website. If not, just go to www.congress.gov. And you can contact either the senator or the House of Representative members. I think they have a place you can put your zip code, and it tells you who your congressman is. you contact your office, you say, look, I have an immigration problem, I need help with my citizenship, who should I talk to? They'll refer you to somebody. Yeah. All this is done over the phone, so.
I see. Because, I mean, physically, the problem here is it is just an RMV report. And I took InfoPass and went there physically and tried to submit. They said they don't accept it. I have to send it through the post.
Yeah, go to your congressman's office. That might be the best thing to do.
I see. Because I've been there like two or three times, and they didn't even open the letter.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of frustrating.
Just go through your congressman's office. They should be able to fix it.
I see. Okay. All thanks
right.
for
good,
that. Bye.
Good luck.
Yeah. Hi, Rajiv.
Yes, sir.
I have one small question.
Yeah. Hang on one second. Did you post a question for us?
No, I didn't.
Just give me one second. What is your... Just make up a name. What is your name?
Pete.
All right, Pete. Folks, anybody else has a question?
Yes, I do have a question, Rajiv.
Thank you very much.
People who have posted.
Yes, I have posted my question.
Which number are you, ma'am?
20. Number 20.
Number 20. I got you.
Okay, actually the thing is, I got a 221G from Chennai Consulate stating that my application would be, you know, sent back to USCIS for further verification.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what do they mean by the verification? I mean, exactly what do they mean
normally,
by
normally, what happens is, if they are not sure about something, there is something in your record that is not clear. And they feel that INS has not taken into an account something that could disqualify the employer or you from getting the H-1. They'll send it back to USCIS and say, did you look at this fact? And then USCIS either says, we did look at this fact, there's no problem. Or they'll say, yes, you're right, this case should be revoked. Then they'll send a notice to your employer saying intent to revoke this case. You have 30 days to respond.
Okay. Did you ever hear about such cases like...
all the time, ma'am. When you've done thousands of cases, then you heard about pretty much everything.
Okay, I mean, what are my chances of getting the H-1?
Nobody can predict that. Nobody can predict that. I have no idea what the problem is.
Okay, recently I got a mail from USCIS that they just received my application and they have started the, you know, verification of my application. So,
yep.
Is there any, like, time limit that I can expect from them?
There is no time limit. I know people who got something from INS within 6 months. I know people who've been waiting 2 years.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, Rajiv. Thanks a lot.
Good luck to you, ma'am. Who else?
Thanks,
was
bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Anybody else who has posted a question?
Rajiv, this is question number 13.
13, all right.
We already discussed about it, but I still have a follow-up question on that.
All right, go ahead.
You did mention about AC-21 in this question, but I really, I just went and read something on online, that on Googling,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't find how it's related to this case. Because the question, just to recall, the question that I...
No, I know what your question is, and I know who you are. I cannot educate you in this short time that we have.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to... AC-21, that's the document you're talking about, but when I look into it, it's something related to 485, that's what I see.
No. Look, if Google could get you everything that you need, why would you pay me $6.60 an hour to do this for you? Okay. And we've been charging... close to $700 an hour for my time for 7 years. I've never increased my fees because I think it's enough. Okay. The reason we charge that much is because we understand the law, and a lot of other people do as well. And we understand many areas of the law. I cannot teach you everything you need to know about the law, but I can tell you this, that you appear to be covered by AC-21. This is a fairly esoteric issue. You want to pay for my time, I'll be happy to sit down with you half an hour and discuss the whole thing with you. Okay? But
okay.
If I'm giving you free advice that this is, you're covered, you're okay, why the hell do you not let it go, man?
Okay.
If you go for surgery, do you have to become a surgeon in order to get your own surgery done? You don't.
No.
Just your lawyer, okay? I won't give you bad advice. I don't think there is a problem here.
Right.
I think you're covered by AC-21. You want to do more research, go to a local law library. Don't try to look at it at Google. You won't get the answer.
Okay. I don't know, when I ask the same questions to my company attorney, he says the same thing, relax and don't worry about all this.
He's right.
He's right.
You want to know more about it, you can ask him to give you the memorandum that, the discussion that Vermont Service Center had a couple of months ago with AILA.
Okay.
They can give you that. Maybe that.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck.
Yes. Rajiv, one more question.
Uh-huh.
Just want to know what's the difference between visa denied and visa rejected.
Wasn't that just, are you trying to illegally squeeze a question in when you're not supposed to?
actually, this is my question. On the
that's okay.
Question.
I don't think there is a difference. I think it's the same thing. No, look, there's a difference between visa denial and there's another thing that another term that they used to use, which was basically they refused to consider the visa application.
Okay.
Now, these are two different things. One means we reviewed the case and we decided not to issue the visa. And the other means we didn't even look at the visa application.
Okay. If the visa is rejected based on 229G, does it mean that it's rejected? Is it considered
rejected?
I don't
know what 229G is. I think you're talking about 222G, if I'm not mistaken.
A220.
Isn't that the section that talks about insufficient documentation?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That's usually no problem at all. That doesn't mean much. Okay. Well, let me rephrase that. I bite my tongue when I said, because I've seen at least one case which they later thought was fraud.
Yeah.
Normally, a 222G, which is insufficient documentation, I think it's 222G, I keep forgetting this section. The one that is insufficient documentation could mean anything from very small to something which could be fairly problematic.
Okay.
It just basically means we can't approve your case.
Okay. At some point, if the visa has been denied based on 222G or 229G, when I fill up my application...
You'll have to say, yes, my visa has been denied.
That has to be said, yes, okay.
But don't worry about that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Anybody else who has posted a question, folks? Pete? Yeah, go ahead.
Probably you must have answered this question. I'm first time listening to you.
That's okay.
People who join other company on the EAD after getting applied for 485.
Mm-hmm.
When is the right time to activate AC21 and intimate the INS?
I like to do it as early as possible, but there is no time limit.
There's no time limit.
There is no
time. In case if it is not done at the beginning of joining a new company.
That's okay.
So that's okay. That's no problem. Because someone also was saying that if by activating earlier, informing earlier, you might end up with asking so many questions.
It's okay. I would rather answer the questions now than answer them in a notice of intent to deny.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's not a problem.
Yeah. If it is not at all intimated, H21, and then have approval if we choose to do, so that also should be fine, right?
That also should be fine, but I don't advise it.
I see. But
that can delay
levels. Risk levels, are there any high risk levels?
Look, let me tell you this. In almost 90% of the cases, maybe even 99, I do inform INS, even though the law doesn't require it.
Uh-huh.
I think it saves you a lot of hassles for citizenship purposes.
I see. So it is just a mere intimation. Is it
just basically a letter that says these two jobs are similar?
Uh-huh. Is it an employer has to do it or an employee?
It is the employee's job.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Not an employer.
Nope.
I'm not a new employer.
Nope.
I see.
All right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I would like to, next time also to attend this telecom.
Of course,
please do. It's quite interesting.
My fear is that I am teaching you all to become lawyers. Before I know it, all of you will be in law school, and that where will I be then?
you will be chief lawyer.
No, I'm just kidding. Of course, I love talking with all of you, and I appreciate the opportunity. All right, folks, good talking with all of you. Take good care, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.